If you're traditionally published, your publisher will likely provide an editor, cover designer, and book formatter. If you receive a five-figure advance, they may also provide marketing and sales support for your book. But if you're independently published, you are in charge of all of these tasks. You can do them yourself and be a self-publisher, or you can hire independent contractors and create your own independent publishing company to become an indie author. We use the term indie author, but what we really mean is that indies run independent publishing companies. They're a real company in the eyes of the law and in the eyes of all of the people who pay the money and in whom they pay money. So the advantage of going it yourself and creating your own company is that you get to choose who edits your book. You get to choose the best cover designer that you can afford, and you get to control how your book is marketed and sold. And you get the data to see what is working and what is not working, which is a very key benefit. So there's a lot of benefits of being the general manager of your own book and of your own publishing company. But with great power comes great responsibility. Savvy independent authors know that doing everything themselves is not the path to success. Just because you're the best author in your subcategory does not mean that you're the best cover designer in your subcategory. In fact, I feel like I can confidently say that you are not the best cover designer in your subcategory. To become the best requires a lot of focus and practice, and if you've done less than 100 covers, you're not it. You could be if you put the work in and had the talent, but you're not. But that's okay, because there are other people out there who are putting in the work and who have the talent. Savvy indies know that they need to create their own company and build their own team. So starting a publishing company may sound overwhelming, but it doesn't have to be. The key is to know what you're doing before you get started. So how do you know what you're doing before you get started? Simple. Just keep listening to this episode of Novel Marketing, the longest running book marketing podcast in the world. I'm Thomas Umstead Jr., CEO of Author Media, and this is a show for writers who want to build their platform, sell more books, and make a living writing books worth talking about. And this episode is for indie authors, both published and unpublished, and anyone who wants or is considering becoming an indie author. And we have a guest on the show today to talk us through the process of starting and running an independent publishing company. She's the co-founder and executive of Archimedes Books and Wolfpack Entertainment. She and her husband publish books through their independent company, and their books have sold 1 million copies and have been translated for foreign markets and adapted into both graphic novels and film. Jennifer Yanez, welcome to Novel Marketing.
Thank you so much. I am excited to be here and to talk all things novel marketing and independent publishers.
Yeah, so tell us your story. How did you found Archimedes Books?
We founded Archimedes Books after being published by a boutique publisher for a season in a series. And as my husband, who is the author, continued to write, we began to grow. We had more titles and more responsibilities, more income and more costs. And after researching and talking with other experts, we knew it was time to create that company to hold all of this responsibility and liability and really taxes. When it comes down to sort of a money game. And from there, we grew into creating a brand. And so for a season, it's been all about Jonathan. So the brand isn't about Archimedes Books in the same way you might know the names of the big publishers, you will know the names of the author. That way, if we added any other authors to it, it could be all about those authors. If any authors wanted to move off and do something different, they could carry that credibility and that brand with them.
Yeah, because the author brand is the one that matters. Most people don't know if it was HarperCollins or Random House that published that last book that they read. So readers really don't know. Authors often don't know as well. But I want to go back to what you're talking about being with a boutique company. And I'm not looking for you to throw shade at the company you were with, because there are some advantages to being with a small company. And it is nice with your first book to not have to learn everything yourself, being surrounded with experts when it comes to the editing and the cover and the rest of it. But there's a big, big downside of working with small publishing houses that it's important for authors to know when they get into it, which is small publishing houses do not offer any marketing help, but they do hurt your marketing because you don't get marketing data from most small publishing companies. And so you are forced to do the marketing yourself. and you're forced to do the marketing blind, which means you're going to sell fewer books with a small publishing house than you would if you went full independent, which is why I suspect once you finish your series, you're like, why are we with the small house? We can do these things. Because another important thing to know, they're just indie authors who've done this before. They're using KDP and all the same tools that you have access to. There's nothing special about a small house. They're not spending thousands of dollars to offset print 50,000 copies of your book, and they don't have an army of salespeople getting those books into bookstores. That's not what small houses do. They don't have the funding for that. And once you realize that you can do everything that a small house does yourself and get the marketing data, there's a big advantage to going indie.
That's literally what we came across. Jonathan spent a few months sending out 100 queries, and he went to those speed dating kind of conferences where it's an author and an agent or someone from a publishing house. And so he began to just step into the world to understand more about it. And we were so grateful. And I still remember the phone call from the agent who picked up Jonathan's first series. And we were in our little tiny kitchen of our first little duplex home and so excited he got picked up. He had quit his other job, cashed in his 401k, and was like, hell or high water, I'm going to make this work. No matter what, I'm going to make this author life work. And that's what he did. And they were supportive and communicative and walked him through the entire process. And the handoffs were very smooth. But that enabled us to see what the steps were and what worked in our favor as well. Is my background is advertising and marketing. I spent about 15 years at a couple different agencies here in Orange County. So I understood the mechanics of how this thinking process goes into development, art design, quality control, printing. And so exactly what you're saying, we were thankful for that first step, getting into the publishing world to have this company, Boutique Publisher. And later on, we gave them another series, but we, you know, checked with them that there was no conflict and started to produce our own stuff. And that came at a time when we just didn't know about the whole KDP world. We didn't know about this massive amount of independent authors and everybody, like, that you can make money doing this, that ebooks were such a hot thing. We grew up on paperback books and we were still reading paperback books. And so this idea of how many people who were reading on e-readers just blew our minds. And so we went to a conference and learned so much, made some great friends. And that's how we launched. It was coming out of our cave, so to speak, and seeing that the world was possible and began fumbling our way through it. Actually, we made all the mistakes, but we learned so much now that's allowed us to be where we are.
Yeah. What were some of those mistakes that you made along the way?
Oh, I did the covers.
Classic. Everyone is convinced that they're the special exception and like, oh, I know all those other authors. They can't do the covers, but I have 7 years in marketing. Surely I can do the covers myself.
I'm not even on that side of marketing. I'm not on the creative side. I am on the client services, strategy planning, spreadsheets, budget side. It was that we didn't have the overhead yet, and we didn't even know where to look to find artists. So for the first series that we launched independently, I did the art, fumbling my way through Photoshop, and then I edited them. So I still had a daytime job. The process for me to edit the books and do the covers was very long. So we didn't know about the timing yet of publishing one book, to pre-order or to establish a cadence or expectation and to build and keep momentum in publishing a series. And we didn't know about writing to market, all those classic mistakes. But it was great because we made those mistakes early on. Like, the losses were small, but the learnings were huge. And so it was absolutely worth it because it reinforced our quest to find the right answers and our value of those investments in a professional editor, in the multiple drafts of editing, getting the beta readers and your ARC readers, and finding professional book cover artists and formatters.
And failure's not as permanent. So those covers that you did, are those still on the books today?
Absolutely not.
So, but this is a key difference. I was talking with somebody who was marketing director for a traditional publishing company. He was explaining how he is now down to just 2 weeks per book. And after 2 weeks, he's pressured to move on to the next book. And so if a book doesn't sell in 2 weeks, he doesn't touch it again. And they're off because they're releasing so many books. And this whole idea of like, oh, we launched the book and it has the wrong cover, which happens. It's very, very common. I would say 80 to 90% of indie books launch initially with a cover that is not good in the sense that you can profitably put ads with that cover and make money with the ads. Maybe 95% of books. And it's not because the covers are ugly. It's just that they're not the kind of cover that gets clicked on. And for a traditionally published book, you very rarely, if ever, see a book cover swapped out for a better cover. But it's very common in indie world. You're like, oh, this cover's not working. Let's put a new cover on there. And it's easier for indies to do this for a few technological reasons. One, indies make most of their money off of ebooks, not paper books. And it's very easy to change the cover for an ebook. But two, even the paper books are printed on demand. And so you can just change the cover and all new books starting tomorrow have the new cover instead of the old cover. Whereas a traditionally published book with 50,000 books in the warehouse, they're not going to shred those 50,000 books and put a new cover on. That's not viable from a financial perspective.
Right. And relaunching books in your backlist or a book that maybe wasn't a hot genre at the time because somebody was ahead of their time or they didn't launch it in the correct genre category, they can relaunch it and reskin it, add a little bit, re-edit it, and the book has whole new life in it. And I think that's another big thing that indies have available to them is that they could breathe life into their backlist. So, you know, if you launch a book series and it didn't go the way as expected or as big a splash, like the adage is nothing sells the last book like the next book, the newest book. And so keep writing because your writing's going to get better. Your sense of stories are going to get better and your sense of your market is going to get better. You'll have all that data and you'll have those that did follow you and they're going to relate to you what it was they liked about your books or your stories or you, your brand, all of that. And so you can go, these are my people and I would like more of these people. And you know, they like what I like. So I'm going to write what I know and what I like. I don't need to go right to market as in chasing the next trend, but I'm going to make sure that the people who like that type of book know that my book is that type of book. And then you can do that again and it begins to compound.
And if you want to learn how to relaunch your book, I have an interview with Chris Fox titled How to Relaunch a Book. And Chris Fox has an excellent book on relaunching books in a great method. It's five levels of a relaunch. And so if you had an indie launch from years ago and it didn't go well, there is a method for relaunching it. We lay it out in that episode. And so there's still hope. Now, maybe that the book needs to get revisited and reworked a little bit. Often people's first books aren't very good. In fact, typically, people's first books aren't very good. So a relaunch won't fix a bad book, but it could fix a bad cover or bad marketing or, oh, I just posted this to Amazon and I expected people to find it. I didn't realize I had to go find my readers myself, which is another common indie mistake. One, I imagine you were able to avoid as a marketing person. You knew you'd have to do the work.
Yes. Well, that was a big aha moment. If one book launched in December, that following summer, we went on vacation and I'm looking through the window after breakfast at this gorgeous view. And I'm sitting there doing Amazon ads. And it was one of those, wait a minute, kind of moments is I'm going to go out later on some excursion, do something fun or beautiful. And the money is going to keep coming in because I've done the work and I've nurtured that sales path, right? And I've introduced this book because it's not like Field of Dreams. If you launch it, they will come, right? It's how many books are there every day put up on Amazon now? Some astronomically hard to comprehend number. And so how does your book get in front of the eyeballs of the right people? And like they're looking for books, but you need to make it easy for them to find it. And so, yeah, that was like, okay, there's something here that there's something in, we love books. We love to write books. We love to sell books. We like to have money to live our lives, not always on vacation. But yeah, it was great to know that we could do that wherever we needed to go.
And it's important to be the book that they're already looking for. So one of the things you mentioned earlier was writing to market. And this is really important if you're trying to be a professional author, if you're trying to run a business, right? This is the approach of running an independent publishing company is different from being a starving artist. There is a totally legitimate path that's most common amongst people who are independently wealthy or who have wealthy spouses, where they're just writing the book that's on their heart and they just want to say what they want to say. And typically they try to hire me to go do the marketing after they've written the whole book without even thinking about the reader. And I always turn them down. And if that's the path that you're on, that's fine. But that's not being a professional indie author. That's not running an indie company. The key part of business is that you're trying to make a profit long term. Doesn't mean you have to make a profit today or this year, but you have a profit motive. This is a for-profit company. We're trying to make money. And to make money in a free market, you have to create something that people freely want. You can't force them to buy your book. That's illegal. And so you have to give them what they want, which means their wants matter. And so, Jennifer, walk us through your evolution of learning to write to market. What did that look like?
Absolutely. The first series he wrote was a sort of YA new adult urban fantasy. The character was 18. They didn't jump time until they were older, 21 and any of that. So they didn't have any of that in the book. And it was a male protagonist. That's not necessarily to market. Urban fantasy tends, not exclusively, there are exceptions, all of that stuff, females, right? So they're either YA young or they're older and they're living a different lifestyle. So that didn't suit. Then it was a supernatural book of angels and Nephilim and all of this stuff. Male protagonist, also again, this time we jumped and went into, he was in his early 20s. That takes on a different feel for the book and goes into a different category, a different reader. But what really kicked off for us was when Jonathan got into sci-fi, because it's a male reader, and as a male writer, he can get into to the stuff that he loved as well. Not that he doesn't love angels and supernatural stuff, but he can get into all the fun, not spaceships as in David Weber spaceships, but have a spaceship to travel through space and encounter big worlds and adventure. And he leaned into that. He had so much fun writing it. And he loved to read it, and he loved superheroes and all of those things and combat. And so all of that got to go into the books. And once we found that audience and found the people who were more conservative in the content that they like to consume, not exclusively, but that they would enjoy, they weren't looking for anything else specifically. And he found his audience there, and we've been there mostly for a while. And Jonathan also has this bit of humor in his books. That's another big thing that we learned, is there was one that had a little bit more humor. Think like Galactic Guardians, irreverent and silly and found family and all that. But we marketed that series as humorous or comedic, and it didn't do well. All of his existing readers liked it, but we couldn't get the new readers to come on in. And we learned like they enjoy comedy. They're just not looking for comedy. So when you say it's comedic and funny and all of that, it undermines all of the thrilling adventure and character interactions that they are looking for within those supernatural worlds.
And a lot of this is trends. So comedy is not a popular category right now in film either, right? When I was a kid, there was a comedy movie coming out every month. I feel like there was all these TV shows that were actually funny. And now I don't actually think any TV shows currently out are funny. And there's no comedies that are doing particularly well in the theater. The only place for humor right now, I feel like, where it's working is in stand-up. And in that place, it's very antagonistic. It's very combative. It's very unorthodox. And it works in that context. But people don't trust, if they don't know you, that your book is actually funny, because there's been so many quote unquote comedies that promised to be funny and that weren't. And so you have to build up the credibility now that your comedy is funny. Whereas if you say, hey, this is action, they believe you that it's action, that you can deliver on the action. And then the humor is a kind of sweet bonus that makes them love you all the more, but it's not what attracts them to you. Sometimes what you keep people with is not what you attract people with.
Right. I agree with that last sentiment, especially because when I look at the reviews or the comments or the people who responded of what they loved about the books, it's that I was laughing so loud I woke up my fur baby. I think part of the reason, too, that comedy may not be doing as well in this season is because there's a shift in comedy of what's considered funny and what kind of funny. Because before, it used to be, like you were saying, antagonistic. But many of those even stand-up comedians are learning to tailor their comedy and how they're delivering it. And so we go to the theater now to see a big movie that may have comedy. We don't know we're looking for that lightheartedness in it, but it's nice to feel good and to have that laughter and share that laughter in the big setting.
I read a fascinating book years ago called The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. And this was trying to scientifically break down humor. And their theory of humor that they defend throughout the book is that humor is a violation that's benign. And it's very context dependent on the audience. So what is benign depends on the audience, and what is a violation depends on the audience. And I think one challenge that Hollywood has especially is that their target audiences are so broad and culture is so fractured that there's no way to be a benign violation for enough of the audience outside of potty humor and kind of really basic kind of Minions level humor. And this is also why humor doesn't travel well across borders. Again, with the exception of the Minions. The Minions do great just about all over the world because that childish slapstick humor is universal because kids are funny. We laugh at them and it's what keeps them alive because they can also be irritating. But that benign violation, to do that, you need to have that specific audience, right? Because what's a benign violation for conservative readership may not be, it may be too much of a violation for a more progressive readership, right? And what is offensive to those groups is very different. And what is benign is very different to those groups. And it's why stand-up works, because comedians get a sense of who their audience is and the audience kind of gets to know who the comedians are. And there's only a certain kind of person who goes to a comedy event to listen to a stand-up comedian, but it makes it harder for Hollywood. But it does work for authors, because you as an author have a smaller target audience and you hopefully have a specific target reader and you can find out if your jokes are funny, but it's harder to test it because you're not on stage trying out new material and seeing if it's funny or not, or if it's too offensive or if it's too benign, right? And it's boring, right? There's a lot of ways to fail in humor. It's a very high risk, high reward communication strategy.
Absolutely. And by the time you've launched the book, you can get some reviews, but what you're going to get is just poor read through on a book or a series. So you can get an idea of how many downloads or page reads something has had, or page reads based on the downloads. If you're looking at just Kindle Unlimited numbers, then that can give you a bit of an indication on that. But yeah, that was a big learning in terms of knowing the audience and missing the mark and trying to recalibrate.
So I'm going to go back to what you said about read through, because this is another very indie way of thinking about creating books. Read through is how much someone has read through a book, what percentage into a book they are. And if you're making money off of Kindle Unlimited, which is a lot of indies making their money off of Kindle Unlimited, $500 million goes mostly to indie authors, split up by who gets the most pages read. So it's not books read, it's pages read. So walk us through how you use read through. How do you measure it? And then how do you use it to make decisions, both marketing decisions and writing decisions?
Absolutely. We look at read through a couple of ways. We look at cumulative read through on a series. So how many people, what percentage of readers read all the way through from book one to book six? And we also assign a dollar value to that based on revenue on the book. So you make, after you have your delivery fee and your percentage that Amazon takes, like what's your actual take home on a book one? And then add that to the percentage of readers who then go to book too. So there's formulas for that. So I won't go into the details of that, but we use that final number. Okay. If we sell every book one we sell of this 6-book series, we're making $13.38 all the way through. I don't know. That's just a number I pulled. That's just an example. And so now every sale of book one is not worth just the $4.99 or $5.99. It's now worth $13.38 for me. So I consider that as I'm doing my marketing, as I'm investing into a series. So instead of looking at a cost per click or number of click to sell through rate, I in the advertising, I'm looking at not $4.99, but $13.38. Also, if a book has a huge drop-off somewhere, we know that there was a problem, an issue in that book. And so we'll go back and look at the reviews to see, did we miss a typo? Is it missing a page or something egregious like that? Or is it simple as we made a story choice that didn't agree with the reader? So we begin to ask and pull that thread to understand better. We've also had a series that came out, book one did phenomenal, and we were very encouraging. Book two was fine. And then we started to see some significant drop off through the series. And so the question we have to ask ourselves, again, going back to this is a business, is should we continue writing in this series? Is this series selling? Is it selling through? Does it have enough momentum to keep people interested to get to the next book? Or is it better to start a new series or write in another series that does have a great following? And so that kind of helps determine our publishing and writing plans and our marketing efforts.
There's a lot of TV show runners who are trying to make that same decision, right? Do we end our show now while we still have a big readership and we can end the show well with a satisfying conclusion? Or do we try to put one more season out there and maybe it'll get canceled and then there's never a satisfying ending at the end? So when I was talking about data, and using data to make decisions, and how if you're not independently published, you don't have access to that data. This is some of the data that I'm talking about, because Jennifer is really well informed and can make really strategic decisions about what series should we keep investing in, what books should we keep investing in, what books should we write, and granular data to the almost to the page level of like, oh, yep, this fell off, right? And do you ever rewrite a book if you realize, oh, this went in the wrong direction, readers don't want that? Or is it more just informing you for next time?
I would say 97% informing us for next time. There is one series that we had published, wrong genre, wrong launch, all the wrong. And so he went in and rewrote it from multiple perspectives instead of just this one 14-year-old kid's perspective, and to bring more of the female element. That her story was there, but he just enhanced it more and put in a bit more of the steampunkness to it so that we could change the genre and the page count and all of that, and beefed up the books. So that was I'd say the one time we've done that. Everything else has just been informing future decisions.
And did that work? Did the rewrite and genre shift improve sales?
It did. Yes. It every time we've touched a book in that way, it's better because we're learning more. The other instances would be like a recover, blurb changes, or the book description, or how we're marketing our books. Like, those are the other things that I mean, informing future decisions or going back as we relaunch. I think there's only been maybe 3 times where we've republished the book under a new ASIN on Amazon to feed the algorithm with new data. That's a whole nother side of data and numbers.
So your husband, Jonathan Yanez, he's writing books pretty quickly, right? So he's following what we would call rapid release. And you talked earlier about finding a cadence, because this is common with indies, is to have a cadence. And I feel like a cadence is really important because readers need to trust that you're going to finish what you start, because especially in fantasy and sci-fi, there's a lot of jilted lovers out there. They're mad at George R. R. Martin. They're mad at Patrick Rothfuss, and they don't want you to be the next person to break their heart. And so they need to know that you're committed to finishing the series. So walk us through your strategy of staying on cadence.
We used to do the rapid release where we'd have the first three books written and ready to go every 2 weeks or every month. And Jonathan used to write 12 books a year or so, or release 12 books a year. And you had to have everything ready to go and back into that next one, because when one book would launch, the next book had to go on pre-order, and you had to commit to the dates. If you miss your pre-order and your launch date and your upload dates on Amazon, you get dinged. And so everything had to be very rigorous, but it also is taxing, and you can, folks can only sustain that for so long. And that was a popular thing for a while. And we have since, we've grown, we have a backlist, we have a bigger committed base of readers. And so we've been able to move to something closer to 6 books a year for a couple of years now. And then our goal is to get to 4 and then 2. What we're looking at is greater depth. And whatever it is, it's like we're being committed, and the reader trusts us to expand those dates in the time between, because we've shown a history of showing up and delivering. And another wonderful thing about, and I know this is probably going to make you cringe a little, is social media. Is Jonathan's very transparent and active and present within his reader groups. And so he'll give video once a month updates, letting people know where things are, where he is in the writing process, what's coming up next. And at first I used to think that was so boring. I was like, why are you just coming in and giving your work agenda to these people? Like, I'm sure they have something else that they'd rather listen to or talk about. And he's like, no, that's what they're here for. They came here for the books. They want to know what's going on. And it wasn't until I happened to see other concerns expressed of, is this book going to get finished? I'm not going to order the pre-order because who knows if this author is even going to deliver. And that is so outside the realm of where my mind goes on how to run a business that it was hard for me to fathom that. And then I have to go back and remember, like, these are aspiring authors. They're not business folks. They didn't go to business school. They didn't come from corporate world. They didn't come from that type of a small business where they had to live and learn and die by their quality and professionalism. They just had fun stories to tell. And so then they're jumping into this, but they become authorpreneurs, and it can kick a lot of bums. It really can. And so I look at those folks with grace and just know that that must have been a struggle for them to have to say, like, I'm not going to make this commitment.
And that's why the readers are so cautious and why they're wanting to see those updates, because they've been burned so many times. Because it's not just the big guys like Rothfuss and Martin. It's also a lot of the indie authors who, you know, overpromised and they were really eager, and then life got in the way and somebody got sick and that they were having more trouble than they're anticipating. And they're like, oh, I'll just miss my deadline by a little bit. And then I miss my deadline by more. And now the readers are afraid you're not going to finish the story. And they regret even having started it. And so I will say, a once a month video update about what you're writing and what's upcoming, that is a Thomas approved use of social media. That's not going on social media every day, right? You post a video to YouTube, you post a video to Facebook. You can put that audio out on a podcast if you want. That's fine. And that's not a big time commitment. That's not spending hours on Facebook groups every week talking with authors about writing. That's what will destroy your writing. It's like, get off those Facebook groups and actually write your book. And some of you are still caught up in, like, how do you write 12 books a year or 6 books a year? Very doable. We have episodes on how to do that. In fact, we're pushing a lot of Chris Fox episodes this episode, but he's got a book on how to write 5,000 words an hour. We have an episode with him about how to write 5,000 words an hour. When I did my episode a few months ago about the tortoise release method, which is a one book a year cadence, I got a bunch of pushback from people thinking that that was too fast. And let me tell you, there's a lot of authors where that would be massively slowing down. It is absolutely possible to write a book in a month and launch a book in the month. And there are authors who are doing that, and they're making good money doing that. Doesn't mean you have to, right? I think the tortoise release method of exactly one book a year, you pick a date on the calendar that's your date. And every February 14th, you give a new Valentine's gift to your readers or whatever, is totally valid strategy. But the key, whether you go on with rapid release or tortoise release or something else, is that you have to stick to your cadence, deliver on your promises, because you're a business now. And if you don't deliver on your promises, if you lie to your customers about when your next book will come out, that trust can't be easily regained.
Absolutely. I agree with you. Whatever your cadence is, set it and follow it. So in a former life, Jonathan's a personal trainer. And so he would tell his clients then, like, you don't have to go at my speed. You go at your speed. It's like one step at a time. If you make the commitment to show up every day, and if you can't fly, run. If you can't run, walk. And the idea is that no matter what, you don't give up and you keep going. And it's the only way you're going to get there. And also a good production schedule. So if you know the book is going to come out on February 14th, you need to back up to the date of when you need to upload, and you need to have your launch plan, your communication plan. And before that, like, when does it need to go into beta readers? Before that, when does it need to go to editing? Before that, when do you need to be done with your editing? Your personal review of that. Okay, based on that, how many words a day or how many words a week or whatever it is you need to write to get to that deadline.
That's running a business, right? If you work at a job, your boss typically is doing that, right? It's like, hey, we have to get 10 widgets out this week in order for us to hit our goal a year from now or whatever. And now that you're the boss, if you're on a publishing company, you got to do the work. So if you're running behind, you know you're running behind, because here's the deal. Life happens and you may not be able to hit your deadlines. And if you're being transparent with your readers the whole time and you're doing those video updates or whatever, they'll give you some grace, especially the first time. And you're like, hey, my mom got sick and she moved in with us. And so I'm running behind on this book. And the release date's been moved back a few months, but I'm still hoping to hit this new date or whatever. They'll be more likely to forgive you than if it's just radio silence and the date that they expected the book rolls around and there's no book.
Yep. Jonathan makes my job as his publisher easy in that his discipline is sickening. He gets up at 5 a.m. and he writes 4,000 words 6 days a week. And so what's nice is even if it's holiday or vacations or whatnot, like, he's up early. So before anyone's getting around for Christmas breakfast or presents or the kids, or if we're visiting family or if we're at Legoland, like, he can up and work and get some of those words in. He also does not get car sick. So if we're traveling to see family, he can ride in the car if we're not too loud. And it's always so impressive to me. But he didn't start that way. He had to find his own rhythm that worked for him. And I want to say that he also read Chris's book about the 500 words a day and writing sprints and how to get into that flow state so he can execute on that regularly.
Yeah. If you haven't read 5,000 Words an Hour by Chris Fox, I think the book's $5 and you really owe it to yourself to read that book. And maybe you're not able to do 5,000 words an hour. Maybe it's only 3,000 words an hour or 1,000 words an hour, but probably it's faster than what you're doing right now. And it's higher quality because the technique that Chris Fox teaches, and we talk about it in the episode, is actually getting basically your full focus, getting the distractions out of the way so that you're not just writing faster, but you're also writing better. And it's also more fun, right? Because that's when you're suddenly in your story rather than writing your story. I'm going to stop this episode here because in the listener survey, y'all were clear that you wanted shorter episodes. But I will say that I talked with Jennifer Yanez for another 40 minutes after this, and I've decided to try something new. Instead of cutting the whole interview down to just 30 minutes, I've decided to post an extended edition to Patreon. So those of you who do want longer episodes will have a link to the hour-long version of this episode on Patreon. The longer version of this episode, we got into book covers, publishing company names, logos, LLCs, S-corps, and a lot of the nitty-gritty details of indie publishing. So if you want to go even deeper on this topic, we'll have a link where you can listen to that episode. In the show notes on authormedia.com, we'll also have a link where you can check out Jonathan Yanez's website. I encourage you to check out his books and his operation that he and Jennifer developed. He sold over 1 million copies as an independent author, and what he's doing is well worth checking out. And thank you to Jennifer, who had so much great information that I didn't want to cut our conversation short. I will also say that Novel Marketing patrons not only will get the extended edition of this episode, but they'll also get a bonus Q&A episode every month and access to all of the previous episodes, all of the previous bonus episodes that I've recorded over the years of having a patron account. And patrons get exclusive discounts on my courses like the Tax and Business Guide for Authors. Speaking of patrons, our featured patron is Jenny Fratsky, who is writing a nonstop, action-oriented Christian suspense about friendship and forgiveness in Montana. And you can find her at jennyfratsky.com. Jenny, thank you so much for being a patron. Thank you for supporting this podcast, helping keep us on the air. I really appreciate your support, and I hope that you do listen to the extended edition of this episode. Our guest today was Jennifer Yanez. Our producer is Lori Christine. Our audio engineering is by William Umstadt, and the blog version is crafted by Shauna Lettler. To read the blog version of this episode, go to authormedia.com/383. I'm Thomas Umstadt Jr. saying thank you for listening, and live long and prosper.